finished the millennium last time, and now we're going to move on to tribulation. As you can tell, we're kind of working backwards, and the reason we did is because we're working from bigger issues, millennialism, down to the view of the tribulation, and those are from the larger issues down to the smaller issues. And where does the Bible teach the tribulation? Well, there's a lot of terms, I think, that are synonymous for the tribulation. And you have on page 42 what we call tribulation terms. I got this from Randy Price's article that he did in the book When the Trumpet Sound, where he found 22 terms that describe the tribulation. The day of the Lord, of course, is the most common one of these terms, which was frequently used, but everything is found initially in the Old Testament, from things like tribulation or time of trouble, that's in Deuteronomy 4, in Zephaniah chapter 1, to birth pains. In fact, that's the famous Jewish term, birth pains of the Messiah. And they believe that before the kingdom was birthed in, so to speak, that there would be birth pains or a time of travail that would precede that, and that would be their analogy or picture of the tribulation. And a day of vengeance, day of wrath. This is why, for example, when Paul in the New Testament talks about the time of wrath, he didn't just pull that term out of the hat. It's defined in Zephaniah chapter 1. And this is important because other people like Marv Rosenthal and others try to come in and chop these terms up and say that they are not synonymous terms or different descriptive terms of the full 7-year tribulation period, but instead they say that they describe various aspects, and I don't think that that's a legitimate approach, and we'll try to show you some reasons why later on. But when you come to the New Testament, some of the major passages, we could deal with a lot of them. So you see, this concept starts in the Old Testament, and it's carried over into the New Testament. But three of the major passages, I think, in the New Testament that talk about the tribulation are Matthew 24, and of course you could look at the parallel passages in Mark 13, Luke 21, Luke 17. Those are all parallel to Matthew 24. But Matthew 24, verses 4 through, I have 14, that probably should run through 28 or so, refer to the tribulation. And I think that verses 4 through 10 refer to the first half of the tribulation. Now, some people see that as referring to the time leading up to the tribulation. For example, people like Calvin see it that way. And as a result, they believe that things like earthquakes and famines and these kinds of things are significant today. But if you locate things like earthquakes, famine, and pestilence in the first part of the tribulation, then they are not signs leading up to the tribulation. Does that make sense? And that's why there's a difference among people that interpret the Bible like we do on whether or not earthquakes are a sign for today. I believe that the first four seal judgments parallel the events in Matthew 24, 4 and following. For example, you have the false Christ, and the first seal judgment in Revelation is the Antichrist, I believe, riding on that horse. And then you have the warning in verse 6 about wars and rumors of wars, and war is the second seal judgment. You see what I'm saying? So I think that these better parallel the first part of the tribulation period in the book of Revelation than they do referring to the period of time that we're now living in leading up to tribulation. But there are those two major interpretive schools within our tradition. I just want to let you know about that. Verse 7, for nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines. And that's the third seal in Revelation, famine. And then the fourth seal is earthquake. So I think that is why this is called the birth pains. See, it says these are birth pains, so I believe the first half of the 7-year tribulation are the birth pains leading up to the midpoint in the second period of half of the tribulation. Then you can go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 through 13. I think this is another major section that deals with tribulation. And there it specifically talks about the Antichrist. If you flip over there, you'll see that it's focusing in on the abomination of desolation and the coming out of the Antichrist. Look in verse 3, let no one in any way deceive you, for it, that being the day of the Lord, the antecedent in the previous verse that he's referring to. And once again, I think that's a synonym from the Old Testament for the tribulation. Let not anyone anyway deceive you, for it will not come, but the fox becomes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. And of course that refers to the midpoint of the tribulation. Matthew 24:15, Jesus in his discourse called the Olivet Discourse refers to that as well. And he adds parenthetically, let the reader understand. And of course, if you've ever been to the 70th week of Daniel, you know it takes some understanding to try to understand that. And so this goes on and talks about how the deception, especially the religious deception that will take place during the tribulation, but this is talking about tribulation period. And also, I think, and we won't go through this, but Revelation chapters 4 through 19 survey the tribulation period. That's why we won't go through that, because it's virtually the whole book of Revelation. But chapters 4 through 19 deal with the time of the tribulation. So this is a time that there's a lot of scripture in the Bible dealing with this 7-year period. Probably next to the life of Christ, there's more volume of scripture dealing with the tribulation period than any other period of biblical history. And so as a result, it's a pretty interesting, significant thing. How long is the tribulation? Well, the tribulation is 7 years. And that is developed from the 70 weeks of Daniel that we just mentioned in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. You might want to flip over there right quick. But you can see that it flows out of the 70 weeks that have been decreed for your people. Let me back up a moment and just point out, remember Daniel was in the Babylonian captivity. He was over in Babylon. And he was, this chapter starts by pointing out that he was reading the book of Jeremiah and had calculated that they were going to be in captivity for 70 years. And he was 2 years away from that time frame being completed. And of course, so he prayed and interceded for the nation. And God gave him a revelation. And I believe Daniel probably thought at this point that they would come back from the Babylonian captivity and the kingdom would come in, basically. In other words, the time of blessing or redemption, as Jews often call it today, the time of redemption would come for the nation of Israel. And God appears to him in a dream and in a sense stretches this out and says, no, Daniel, there's 70 weeks of seven. So you can see that that is a play off of the 70-year captivity. And he stretches it out to 490 years. So the 70 weeks or 70 heptads refer to years. No one debates that. That's unanimously admitted. And they said they have been decreed for your people and your holy city. So it focuses on Israel, the Jewish people, and the city of Jerusalem. And it cites six things that are going to be accomplished when this is finished. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Now, many try to say that this was all fulfilled at the first coming of Christ. However, I think probably none of them were fulfilled, although the basis for fulfillment in Christ's death, burial, and resurrection was. But these were not applied to who? To your people and your holy city. But at least the last three certainly have not been fulfilled, even if the first three were at the first coming. and that is to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy. And that means everlasting righteousness, I think, is a term relating to the millennium, which is what that Daniel was looking for. But to seal up vision and prophecy means that God's seal of fulfillment have not yet brought prophecy to its completion and fulfillment. And then to anoint the most holy place, this refers, of course, to initiating what we now know from later biblical revelation, the millennial temple that will be anointed in a big way. And he continues in verse 25 and says, so you are to know and discern. The word discern means to have understanding that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 70 weeks and 7 weeks and 62 weeks. And so here we have the decree issued as recorded in Nehemiah chapter 2 verses 1 through 8 by Artaxerxes, the Medo-Persian king, on March 5th, 444 B.C. And this is dated specifically. And this is what I'm saying. This is what makes the Bible different. I mean, this is something that either it did or it did not happen. And this is why it says you're going to have 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So how many is 7 and 62, class? 69. So when he says after the 62 weeks, in verse 26, how many weeks is that? If you have 7 and 62, and something's going to happen after the 62, how many total weeks? 69. Right? Yes. So something's going to happen after the 62 weeks. And what's going to happen are three things. The Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come, and the prince who is to come is a reference to the Roman Antichrist. Because we know that because he is referred to in Christ is called Messiah the Prince in the middle of verse 25, and then it says, it will be built again with plaza and mud, even in times of distress. And of course, the book of Nehemiah and Ezra record this. But the prince who is to come is different from Messiah the Prince, and he will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And of course, that refers to what happened in AD 70. And that's how we know it refers to the Roman emperor or the Roman prince who is the Antichrist. And its end will come with the flood. Even to the end, there will be war, desolation, are determined. And he, referring back to the prince who is to come, and in this instance, it is the Antichrist. Why? Because this is a future event, and this is the basis for the gap between the 69th and 70th week. Many people who do not take the Bible prophecy literally are very critical of us that believe there's a gap between the 69th and 70th week. But we believe there's a basis for this because it says that after the 62 weeks, in other words, certain things will take place after the 69 weeks. And so here you have the 70 weeks or the 490 years starting March 5th, 444 B.C., and 483 of those years were completed. I have it all written out for you on page 43 of your syllabus. And so that on March 30th, A.D. 33, this ended the 483 years or the 173,880 days. That this composed of based on a 360-day year, not a 365 and a quarter, as we have. This was the very day that Christ rode into Jerusalem on the little donkey, the triumphal entry. And this is why in Luke 19, he said, if you had known the time of your visitation. See, there was good reason for people to know and expect Messiah during his first coming. If for no other reason than for this, because you had specific prophetic statements of when he was to come. And so this is why he's saying, if you had known the time of your visitation, and I think that's a reference in Luke 19 too, the completion of the 69 weeks that he was talking about here. And Messiah is cut off after the 69 weeks. So three or four days later, something like that, that Christ was killed. And then he rose again. And that happened after the 62 weeks. In other words, after the 69 weeks. So that started this gap or period in between there. And then it says, he will make a firm covenant, and the nearest antecedent is the prince that is to come. And that's why this has not happened yet. And the only way you can have a literal fulfillment of this passage of the 70th week of Daniel, because there's no other event, if you were to add 7 years to the day of the triumphal entry, there's nothing that happens. To make a long story short, my good friend Randall Price wrote an article in the book Issues of Dispensationalism, Defending the Gap, and he shows there's no other possible interpretation that takes the 70th week, or that final 7 year period, literally, just as we took the 483 years literally, that works out. And that's why we're driven to a gap between the 69th and 70th week. You understand this? This is the logic or the basis of the reason. And that's why we know that it's future. It's been postponed, and it's kind of like a basketball game where a foul has been committed, and the clock stops until things are set right, and then the time will start running off again. And it's kind of like that. And that's why, in the meantime, God is working through the church, to, as Acts 15 says, to call out a people for his name. And then, this is how we know that the tribulation is 7 years, because he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. Now, if you study consecutively through the book of Daniel, like I had before, you'll know that the many is a phrase referring to the Jewish people. The technical term in the book of Daniel to refer to the Jewish people. And so other passages like Isaiah refer to this covenant between the European Antichrist, because he's coming from where? The revived Roman Empire. And we know that from Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. And he's building on his revelation here in Daniel chapter 9. And he will make this firm covenant with the many for 1 week, 7 years. And that's where we get the link of the tribulation period. And some people think that the Jewish people will accept the Antichrist as their Messiah, or false Messiah. The Bible doesn't say that. I don't hold that view. It simply says that they will make a covenant with the Antichrist. It doesn't mean they have to believe that he is the Messiah or the Christ, but it simply means that they make a covenant with the one who is the Antichrist. And of course, in the midpoint of tribulations, we'll see later, they realize he promises them peace and safety. In other words, he solves the Middle East crisis in essence, as we know today. And that's what's happening today with all the events. No matter what's happening in the news today, I can tell you that it's leading us to what? To putting Israel and the nations into a posture where they will look to an individual to solve whatever the mess is over there. And that's what's happening. It's stage setting going on right now that will lead to the European Antichrist. In fact, just in the last month, there's a big clamor by the Palestinians to let forget the United States, the fact that they're bashing Bill Clinton, they're saying he's got a failed foreign policy, this guy doesn't care about foreign policy. I'm telling you what they say. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. Of course, y'all know my bias. But I'm saying this is what you read in the Jewish press over there, and the Arab press as well. I get reports on the Arab, surveys of the Arab press. They're saying, let's turn to Europe. This is why Chirac was over there 2 weeks ago. All these years, the Russian foreign minister was over there. They want to become a player. This is why the rotating head of the EC comes over there about every month. And the Arabs want the Europe to get more involved. And there's whole articles with headlines saying Israel turning to European solutions, things like that. Are coming out, and that's exactly what's going to happen. And it may be in God's timing that Bill Clinton's disinterest in foreign policy could be used to set, to prepare the way for Europe becoming more involved in settling the Middle East crisis in this way. And then it says in the middle of the week, and that's where you get the 3.5 years, he will put stop sacrifice and grain offering on the wing of abomination will come one who makes desolate, even a complete destruction, one who is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. And this is further described in Matthew 24:15 and 2 Thessalonians 2 that we looked at, Revelation chapter 11, and Revelation chapter 13 talks about receiving the mark of the beast, and on throughout the rest of the book of Revelation where it's referred to 5 or 6 times. By the way, the Antichrist is his term that's only used one time to refer to a future coming Antichrist in 1 John chapter 2. However, we use this term because in the early church, this became the most popular term for the guy we know as the Antichrist. The term the beast is used 36 times in the book of Revelation alone, and it's used in the book of Daniel as well. So you would think we'd call him the beast. He's got at least a dozen to two dozen names or descriptions of the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, and all of these other, man of son of perdition, these kinds of other names. But the Antichrist historically is a term that's always been used, so I guess that's what we're stuck with, so to speak. But it's only used once to refer to the future Führer, that's how Lindsay called him in his famous book, Like Great Planet Earth. But 36 times he's called the beast in the book of Revelation and a number of other times in the book of Daniel as well. And so here's an outline of the tribulation period. It flows from the 70 weeks of Daniel. And then in the book of Revelation in the New Testament, it refers to the 3.5 years, the 42 months, the 1,260 days. And I believe it refers to the first half in one part and the second half in the other. And so that 7-year period is reiterated in 3.5 year increments in the New Testament in the book of Revelation. So that's where we get it from. It's developed out of these passages. Now, what are the purposes of the tribulation? First of all, there's at least three. I mean, you could break this down into a lot of sub-purposes for why God is having this tribulation. Basically, the general purpose, I don't have this in the notes, is that God has to first judge the sinful world before he can set up his kingdom of righteousness and holiness, you see? That's just the broad, basic reason for the tribulation, that judgment has to precede the period of the millennium, of the 1,000-year reign of Christ. But specifically, it's to punish the world for its sins against God. And that's pointed out in Isaiah 13:9 and Isaiah 24:19-20. And this involves, as you read the book of Revelation, the rejection of Jesus as Messiah and other reasons. It's basically a time of judgment on the world for their wickedness. And that's why I hear people say today, you know, that God's going to judge America. Well, I think he is, but he's going to judge the rest of the world, too. We're not that special that we're going to get judged all by ourselves, necessarily. I mean, God may judge America before he judges the rest of the world, but I don't think there's any biblical basis for saying that. But God's going to judge the whole world. It's not just America. We're bad, but so is the rest of the world. Let's not leave them out. Now, the second reason is to bring about worldwide evangelization and mass conversion. And this is what Matthew 24:14, let's turn to the New Testament and stop by Matthew 24. And we see another passage that is often, in my opinion, taken out of context. But here it says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come." And this is often used by missions organizations to say that we have to preach the gospel to all the nations before the Lord can return. Well, this passage is referring to events related to the 7-year tribulation, and it's not talking about evangelism during the church age necessarily. Now, the Great Commission of Matthew 28 and its parallel passages is good enough for preaching the gospel to the whole world. but I don't think this passage specifically applies to it. It refers to events that are going to take place in the tribulation. Now let's turn to Revelation and get an even clearer picture, I think, of this. And we'll start in Revelation chapter 7, where and I believe the tribulation is going to be a time of tremendous conversion to Christ by Jew and Gentile alike. But here in Revelation, and you have 144,000 Jewish witnesses who apparently will be scattered throughout the whole world, who will be preaching the gospel in a miraculous way. I don't want to go into why, but basically I think the Apostle Paul, when he says he was one born out of due time, was in a sense one who was would be like one of the 144,000 who was born early. Out of due, actually that word due time means to be born late, but unexpectedly, like a woman having a baby after she's passed the time. That's what that word literally refers to. But Paul was one who was born out of due time early in the church, and look what he did, and apparently these 144,000 would be tremendous evangelists. So you're going to have normal evangelization by people like you and I. You're going to have the 144,000, and look what it says in verse 9 of chapter 7. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count from every nation, all tribes and people and tongues, standing before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. So a palm branch symbolized victory. They were overcomers, if you will. And here, you have every breakdown, or way you could look at the breakdown of the Gentile nations. Nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues. There's going to be at least one, maybe you can make cases of plural, at least two converts from every one of these subgroups during the tribulation, because this is the product of the 144,000. And so this is referring specifically to that. And then you go to Revelation chapter 13, or 14 rather, and you see them talking about the 144,000 again. Earlier, chapter 12, 13, around in there. And what's interesting is in chapter 14, you have three angels at the midpoint of the seven-year tribulation right here in conjunction with this. And look what it says that they do. And so you have the 144,000 normal evangelists, the 144,000, the two witnesses in Jerusalem who are especially evangelizing the Jewish people. And then you have a fourth evangelistic factor, and that is the angels are going to evangelize. Well, it says, and I saw in verse 6 of chapter 14, and I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven. There, that means in the sky. Airplanes, for example, flying in the mid-heaven. Having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth. Eternal gospel stresses the significance of the gospel. See, this is an eternal decision that impacts your eternality, where you're going to spend eternity. It's like the most important decision that you can be confronted with, the gospel. And they had this gospel to preach to those who live on the earth, to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. The same phrase that's used in Revelation 7:14. I remember studying the book of Revelation for years, and somehow I missed this. The angels, at the midpoint of tribulation, we'll show you why it's the midpoint in a moment, are going to preach the gospel in addition. The people are going to know what's going on in tribulation. By the way, I had this post-trib guy that called me from Colorado. He called me up this week, and he told me we could be almost at the midpoint of the tribulation. And I said, you know, that's one. And I spent all these times, you know, going over problems with post-tribulation ones. And I said, just think, we're 3 years in the tribulation and we don't even know it. I mean, this is just ridiculous. You're going to know it. You're in it. Believe you me. Well, and he didn't even know where the signing of the covenant was. He thought it could be the Oslo Accords. I said, that's ridiculous, because that is not a covenant made between the European Antichrist
And he thinks Prince Charles is the Antichrist.
He does.
Well, I said, yeah, he's as good a candidate as any. I mean, we've got a few here in America that he could suggest, but we won't at this time. I've had a few at some of our family reunions, and I know some people have suggested me once or twice. But you never know. The fact of the matter is can you imagine being 3 years into the tribulation and not knowing it? And this is the way you have to, I always say you have to spiritualize these things. With when you take the Bible literally, these are going to be clear events. And you have the signing of the covenant. Can you imagine people not knowing that? And he said, well, he heard Prince Charles was involved behind the scenes in that. And I said, this wasn't even a covenant between the Palestinians and the Jews. It wasn't even between Europe. But he stressed it because it was from Europe, Oslo.
And no peace going on.
Well, not only that, Norway was not part of the Roman Empire previously. But, that, you know, these little details. But he says he interprets the Bible literally. And I said, boy, I'd hate to see it if you spiritualize the Bible. But this was the hot new revelation he had for me that we could be right. And I said, what are they going to do? Have a prefab temple pop it up in a month? You know, there's not even a temple over there. And we could be 6 months away from the middle of the tribulation. But here you have an angel flying, and he preaches with a loud voice that says, fear God and give him glory because the hour of his judgment has come, the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. And worship him who made heaven and earth and the sea and the springs of the water. And we could say today in light of the environmentalist movement, worship God and not the springs and the water and all of these things like some do. However, this is in preparation before the start of the Antichrist, which is in chapter 13, issuing the mark of the beast. And so there's an angelic warning so people will know. And then you have a second angel in verse 8, and another angel, a second one. So you got to be really have insight to understand the revelation, right? Second angel. Followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all the nations drink of the wine and passions of her immorality. And so this is why there's a focus on Babylon. I won't get into who is Babylon, where it's Iraq or Revival Roman Empire or whatever, Catholic Church or whatever. I'm not getting into that issue. But the point is, at the midpoint, judgment is pronounced 3.5 years before it happens. They're just a sure thing. Yes.
You kind of move quickly over the issue of the mark of the beast. That is to happen at the midpoint of the 7 years. So you already have 3.5 years of warning that this is coming.
Yes.
Okay.
If you know the Bible. And I think this is the strong delusion that is talked about in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. But the same half. And we're going to see in a moment later on tonight, our next two overheads from now, that the first half of the tribulation, the Antichrist rules Europe. And the second half, starting with this event here, he attempts to rule the world. And that attempt to rule the world is associated with receiving the issuing and receiving the mark of the beast. If you want more information, get our little booklet on the Antichrist or the Coming Catholic Society, where we deal a lot with those issues. Now, the third angel and another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives the mark on his forehead upon his hand, he also will drink of the wine of the wrath of God. And we know that later on this refers to the Battle of Armageddon, when this will happen right before the Second Coming or at the Second Coming, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. It goes on and talks about some other nice little descriptions that will warm your heart. And so, this is not something that people are going to be tricked into doing. This is something that people are going to know what they are doing. You see what I'm saying? It's a clear setup of who you're going to follow, God or Satan. And it's not something that people are going to just make a mistake one day, you know, like they fell asleep and they went to the tattoo shop and asked to come home and fix their sick, and they didn't know how they got it. This is something that's going to be real clear. Now, my question is, where is Dennis Rodman going to put his? I don't think he has any room on his forehead or right hand.
What color hair
is
he
going to
have?
I don't know. I don't know. But hopefully he will know Christ as a Savior, and that won't be a problem. So I just seen the trend nowadays to get tattoos all over your body. I'm wondering where some of these people are going to get it, or where they're going to put it. But that was just a little devious thought that entered my mind one day. So the second purpose of tribulation, as you can see, is evangelism. There's going to be phenomenal evangelism going on. And then the third purpose of the tribulation is to prepare Israel for conversion before the second coming. And this is a major purpose. And if you look in, this is Daniel chapter 12. Let's look at Romans chapter 11, verse 25 through 27. Because Romans 11, Paul says, I do not want you, brethren, to be misinformed, so uninformed of this mystery, lest you be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullest Gentiles has come in. And this is what's happened to those in the church who teach that Israel has no future. See? Who put the church up above Israel. Israel has been hardened, but it's partial. In other words, it's not permanent. It's temporary. And he's saying, don't become arrogant. Later on, he talks about being arrogant towards the branches. And that's what happens to those that believe that Israel doesn't have a future. They've become arrogant toward the nation of Israel and think that God is only working, well, right now he is only working through the church, but that's not going to be true in the future. And by the way, this is the basis for the preacher rapture, one of the basis of the logic of the preacher rapture, to complete his current program so that he can return and finish his program with Israel, the 70th week. And thus all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion, and who will remove ungodliness from Jacob, and this is my covenant with them, when I take away their sins. And so the point is, there's many passages in the Old Testament that talk about how the nation of Israel, especially like in Zechariah, where it says that they will pass through the fire, and the two parts will be killed or destroyed. So apparently two-thirds of Jews alive during the tribulation will be martyred or killed. And the one-third that's left will be elect, or the remnant, meaning that every Jew who's alive at the second coming, right before the second coming, will be saved. And that's what I think this passage means. All Israel will be saved. If you take all the Old Testament passages, put them together about the tribulation, so you can see, it's to prepare Israel for conversion before the second coming. Because the second coming has to be an invitation from the nation of Israel for Christ to return. And they will do that. When they look upon him whom they have pierced, Zechariah 12:10, when they weep as one weeps the only son, and this is typified in the event of Joseph, when he appeared to his brothers the second time in Egypt, and they wept when he revealed himself to his brethren, the 12 tribes, and they realized what they had done, and they were afraid. And this is a type or picture of that. And the second coming is a rescue event. It's Jesus Christ coming back to rescue the nation of Israel, who is about to be slaughtered by the nations who have gathered at the Battle of Armageddon. And if you take all the Old Testament passages and put them together, apparently Christ will first come back to Bozrah and pick up the Jews who are hiding out in Bozrah, or modern-day Petra in Jordan. And by the way, people say, oh, that's stupid that the Jews are going to flee to Petra. I remember the last time I was over in Israel, our guide, Ellie, we were out in the Judean wilderness in the bus, and he just started talking about how they love, it's a big thing in Israel to go on a hike in the Judean wilderness. People do it all the time, apparently, who live in Jerusalem. And they go out and they'll hike out 40, 50 miles out one way and hike back. And he was talking about how they do that all the time, regularly, like once or twice a year. It's very common. And he was talking about how you had to watch out for the flash flood, or they'll get you. And then, did you notice 2 years ago when they made the treaty with Jordan? And I remember reading in the Jewish media, something like 98% of the people in Israel who wanted to go to Jordan wanted to go visit Petra. They're fascinated with it. I remember reading stories about that 3 years ago, and the Jordanians were complaining that that's the only place they wanted to go. You know, why didn't they want to go to other places in Jordan? They all wanted to go visit Petra. For some reason, it didn't say why they were fascinated with Petra, but for whatever reason they were. And that's the big tourist spot in Jordan for Israelis, is to go visit Petra. And so this is all related here to biblical prophecy. So what's the timing of the rapture? Well, since there are four possible times with the tribulation to take place, guess what? There are four views. If there are four possibilities, there will be four views. And some believe that the tribulation has already happened. That's called preterism, Latin for past. And basically they say the tribulation happens between the time of Christ and the many say it literally took 3.5 years during the time of the Jewish wars that led to the destruction of Jerusalem in the summer of AD 70, when Titus ran, and the 36-month period that led up to that, starting with the battle in Caesarea. And in fact, I've signed a contract to debate a preterist, Ken Gentry. And I'm, of course, going to argue for futurism in a book, and he's going to argue for preterism. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to speak at their class, at one of their colleges. I've got an hour to talk to them. They're preterist post-millennialists.
I think that's Shelton's viewpoint.
Well, they're similar, but this is Ken Gentry, who has really is the top Reconstructionist eschatology expert. Shelton is kind of, after he wrote his commentary, you haven't heard much out of him. But I'm sure once I speak there, the next day they will spend 2 or 3 hours going over whatever it is I say. Then the other view is historicism. And this is a view that was widely held up until about 100 years ago. In fact, it's called the Protestant view. And that is the view that basically teaches that the church age and the tribulation are synonymous. Remember how we were talking about in amillennialism and postmillennialism? People believe that amillennialists and postmillennialists believe that the church age and the kingdom or the millennium are synonymous. These are people who believe that the whole church age is the tribulation, and they spiritualize a whole lot. In other words, a lot. And most of them tend to say days mean years. For example, the 1,260 days, those are really 1,260 years. And so if the tribulation began, say, in 313, when Constantine, the Antichrist, the Roman Antichrist came and Christianized the Roman Empire, and you add 1,260 years of that to 313, then you end up with 1560-something, like Martin Luther speculated was to be the second coming. And to be a historicist is to be a date setter. In fact, our little booklet on date setting explains all of this. I don't have time to go into it, but it explains why. And this is why Seventh-day Adventists and Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, they're all historicists. And this is why Jehovah's Witnesses are big date setters, because their movement started in the 1800s when this was big. In fact, Seventh-day Adventist movement started out of the William Miller philosophy, where he said that the 2,300 days of the Book of Daniel were really 2,300 years, and it began in 586 B.C. with the coming in of the times of the Gentiles, and so you add that up and you ended up in 1843. Well, he put a year in there, and there's no 0 year, so he said really it's 1844, and of course about 1 million people thought Christ was coming back then, and that's where the Adventist movement started, out of what's called the Great Disappointment when Christ did not return. But these are very different than historians. David Koresh, for example, was out of that tradition. And he was teaching that he was going to break the seventh seal, the book of Revelation, which meant Armageddon was going to happen, and then Christ was going to return. And so he believed that they were on the verge of Armageddon. This is why I remember when the Gulf War happened, I was living in Austin, Texas, and there was a front page story by Seventh Day Adventists saying this could be Armageddon. See, we wouldn't believe that this could be Armageddon, because you have to go through the seven literal years leading up to Armageddon, right? The rapture has to happen. But if you're a historicist, then you are going down, counting down these kinds of events. And historicism was so widely held by Protestants, whether you were post-mill, on-mill, or pre-mill, everybody was a historicist up until about 150 years ago. And then there's futurism, and that's what we hold. We believe that the tribulation is future. Millennium is future. And so we believe that prophecy is yet fulfilled. And then there's idealism, which teaches that either God hasn't revealed the timing factors, or it's not important. And so someone like that preaches about prophecy in the book of Revelation as simply moral stories that should inspire us that we're going to win. We're going to win. You know? And you tell a story from the book of Revelation and everybody goes out, charges out, and wins, I guess. But these are the four possible things. And if you think it's hard enough understanding pre-mill, on-mill, post-mill, and then pre-trib, mid-trib, throw in all this, you end up with about 12 different combinations, you see? And that's what makes this stuff complicated, is the blending of these different interpretive factors that make things complicated. So you can understand why nobody, if everybody was who were premillennial was historicist 150 years ago, and they by and large were, and the church age is tribulation, then it's impossible to believe in the preacher rapture, right? If you're in the tribulation, then you can't believe in the preacher rapture. And this is why it wasn't until futurism came in a pot that was restored, the early church was somewhat futuristic in profession, why in the early 1800s, when futurism came in, literal interpretation came in, that people began to believe again in the preacher rapture. You see what I'm saying? There's reasons why these things are true. Now, what are the major events and personalities of the tribulation? I'm glad you asked. We've already touched on many of these, but here you have the tribulation events. Of course, does the rapture start the tribulation class? No. The rapture ends the church age, right? But what starts the tribulation? The signing of a covenant. So therefore, it's possible to have a gap of time. It may be days, it may be weeks, it may be months, it may be a year or two, I don't know. But it's possible to have that. So that's why the stage doesn't have to be totally set for the rapture to occur. Because I remember reading Clarence Larkin in 1917, his book was published, saying that he thought there would be a 50-year gap between the rapture and the start of the tribulation. Why? Jesus said Israel has to return to the land, they have to rebuild their temple, they have to get Jerusalem back, but Babylon has to be rebuilt and all this. And so he was saying that he thought that would take at least 50 years. Well, many of these events have already happened. They weren't required to happen for the rapture to happen, you see. But they have happened. The preparation for the tribulation has come into focus even more, and so it probably will require less time. Now, the Antichrist is head during the first 3.5 years of the Western nation, and Israel is protected by the covenant. That's what starts the tribulation, is a covenant to protect Israel. And you have the first 3.5 years, the apostate church, that which is vomited out of Christ's mouth in Laodicea, if you can picture this, is that it's not individuals who are truly saved. They are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb, Revelation 3:20, the proper interpretation. The invitation to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And in a sense, the Laodicean apostate church is vomited into the tribulation, if you will, out of Christ's spewed out of Christ's mouth and becomes the basis for the harlot who helps assist the Antichrist rise to power, as pointed out in Revelation 13 with the false prophet. And you have the restoration of the Jewish Levitical system, and then you have that famous event in the middle of the tribulation, the abomination of desolation, and that's when he declares that the world has to take the mark of the beast. He's not handing out the 666 in the first 3.5 years. And this is when he declares himself to be world ruler, and this is why Israel, according to Matthew 24 and Revelation 12, is to flee to the wilderness, because now he turns from protecting Israel to persecuting Israel. And that's when the Jews in Israel will flee to Bozrah, and God will miraculously protect them. You know, I've sat down like you probably and wondered, doesn't the Antichrist know they're going to be a hanging out in Bozrah? I mean, what? I don't know. I think he knows that, or potentially he knows that. But God says he's going to protect him, so I guess he's going to protect him somehow. But, you know, it's there in the Bible, and you would think he could read that. But he's going to persecute them, and they will be protected. The remnant will be protected. And you will have the worship of Satan and Antichrist, the great tribulation, the last 3.5 years, and the preparation leading up to Armageddon, which is the battle that never takes place as far as its original intent. It does take place in that God, the Armageddon is supposed to be the nations coming against the nation of Israel to defeat her, but God turns them and they turn and fight him, and he wipes them out real fast. And you have the trumpet judgments and then the bowl judgments that come in rapid succession leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And these are the highlights and events of the tribulation. So I can't imagine being here, can you, and not knowing it. So what are some of the major events? Well, there's the seal judgment, as we pointed out, the rise of the Antichrist, 10-nation confederacy in the first half, the ministry of Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord, the last 3.5 years, and he will help to turn the hearts of the children back. John the Baptist would have been Elijah. He came in the spirit and power of Elijah had they accepted, but they didn't, so he wasn't. The preaching of the gospel through the 144,000, the ministry of the two witnesses, and isn't that a wonderful picture? They get killed, apparently some point, midpoint in the tribulation, and these people apparently so bothered everybody that it says they're going to have a new holiday. We got enough holidays as it is, I know, but this is going to be such an important event that they says people will have a holiday and exchange presents because the two witnesses will have finally been killed. I mean, what do? Interview them every night on Nightline or something? You know, this will probably be the new focus of Nightline every night going on there. And they're finally killed, and then their body lays triumphantly, apparently, in the street. And 3.5 days later, it says they are resurrected. They stand up. And you can imagine, I guess everybody goes and takes their presents back, or something like that, but you can imagine the disappointment. And then they are taken up, raptured, that's the word from Harpazo, raptured up into heaven and taken out of the way. But it shows God's victory there at this point. And like I say, these are real historic events that are going to happen. Remember the little boy in the movie? It could happen. Hey, it's not. It could happen. It will happen. And then you have the false church that we've already talked about, and then the middle of the tribulation, the little scroll, and those are particular judgments that are meted out. Then the Antichrist is killed. Satan, of course, is cast down at the midpoint of the tribulation out of heaven, right? And many believe, it's speculation, that he will then enter the Antichrist. But the Antichrist is a normal human being. Up to this point, though, Satan personally, apparently, and that speculation enters him, and that's what relates to his being resurrected. He is killed and resurrected. And there's debate as to whether or not this is going to be a pseudo-death and a pseudo-resurrection, meaning not he really didn't die, he really wasn't resurrected, but he trick people into making them think that. However, I tend to lean towards the direction thinking that he really does die, and he really, God says that he gives power for a short period of time to the beast. 2 Thessalonians 2 says that God sends them a strong delusion so that they believe the lie of those who love not truth, unbelievers. And so I think God greases the fly. When I was a little boy, we often had family reunions and we'd go to public parks and try to go down that slide and you couldn't go very good. My dad would always give us wax paper. And after about 4 or 5 times going down the slide with wax paper, you started going pretty good. Well, that's kind of what God is doing to unbelievers. He greases the slide. It's like Pharaoh. You know, and the Old Testament clearly makes it clear that one of the things that hardens people in unbelief is what? The preaching of the Word of God. If a person is negative to the Word of God, the more you preach the Word of God, the more negative they become. Pharaoh is a classic example. It hardened him, hardened him, hardened him, hardened him. Hebrews 6 warns about that type of hardening. And this is what's going to happen. But I think God, during this brief period of time, is temporarily going to give supernatural power to Satan that I don't think he has now to perform an actual resurrection that will harden people in their unbelief. And God, that will be the delusion called the false signs, wonders, and miracles that the Bible warns about during the tribulation. So the Antichrist is killed, Satan's cast down to the earth from heaven, as I mentioned, the resurrection of the Antichrist, as we talked about, and 3 kings are killed in 7 cements. This is referring to the 10 nations European Confederacy, which he is solidifying during the first 3.5 years, and in the middle point, getting ready to launch his worldwide campaign. If we could say in today's terms, you get rid of political enemies and solidify. Then you have the destruction of false churches. So the little harlot, as the Bible calls her, is cast aside after she helps the Antichrist come to his position. And then you have the death and resurrection of the 2 witnesses we talked about, the worship of the Antichrist relating to the mark of the beast, 666, the false prophet, and second half of Revelation 13 says he's the propaganda machine, the Goebbels, who tells everybody to do it. And so religion plays a role. Put this in your pipe and smoke it. In other words, false religion ends up directing people to worship Satan. False Christianity. And the false prophet is the front, number 2 guy for the Antichrist, the PR guy. And then you have the 666, the mark of the beast. 7-year covenant is then broken in the midpoint, as Daniel chapter 11 and Isaiah 28 say. And the abomination of desolation, which is that event where Antichrist goes in and sets himself up in the Holy of Holies in the rebuilt temple. And then you have the persecution of the Jews. That's why they're to flee, as we mentioned. The trumpet judgments then start. And these are all judgments. And by the way, I think this is an important point to make here.